welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Today, two stories from Andrew Forrester. Real name, James Redding Ware. He was a British writer, novelist, and playwright, and creator of one of the first female detectives in fiction. Today we offer two stories from his collection of stories called Secret Service, or Recollections of a City Detective. Our first story is called The Duke's Mystery. And now our story. Little more than 5 years ago, a series of robberies on a grand scale was perpetrated at the West End of London. There was hardly a tradesman of note who did not suffer from these depredations, which for a long while baffled all the skill and vigilance of the police. After a lapse of perhaps 6 months from the formation of belief that these robberies were the result of a concerted action by the rascaldom of the metropolis, the victims and their friends formed themselves into a committee, and I was retained to investigate the affair. As the matter had by this time assumed great importance, I employed 5 or 6 assistants and systematically went to work. The police were also on the alert, and special instructions were given from Scotland Yard that they should cooperate with me, or practically, I may say, act under my instructions. It would be tedious to relate all the disguises and stratagems which I assumed and devised. It must suffice to say that 6 men went through more variations in their appearance than the chameleon, and were nearly or quite ubiquitous during the investigation. I saw that a gang had to be crushed. I knew that success or failure was but an issue of time and money. Of the former, I could give and get as much as the associated tradesmen would pay for. Of the latter, there would, I believed, be no stint. The parties affected, and liable to be affected, by the operations of the gang, were prepared to lay out all the cash needful to secure the punishment of the criminals. The job was not a light one. We made a few mistakes, to the injury, however, of no one who had a character worth keeping. We got, at times, on wrong tracks. We were often on the heels of the thieves, and yet failed to grasp them. We were none of us faint-hearted, or lacking in patience. Each trip only made us walk the more carefully. Each blunder only made us wary. Each divergence only made us examine the supposed clues with greater nicety. One morning, a police constable and one of my men came to me with news. "We have a clue, sir," said Police Constable U-99. "That's well. What is it?" I observed. "At least, I think we have," said my assistant. I told him of it. "I found it out," added the constable. "No, don't say that. I had most to do with it." "How did you make that out?" "Well, how much did you know about it before I told you of it?" "And how much did you know when you told me of it?" I saw that there was a pretty quarrel brewing between this pair of worthies, and I tried to stop it, but that was not so easy a task as the reader may at first be inclined to suppose. If I put a restraint on my assistant for the sake of peace, I might be incidentally puffing up the constable's vanity and wantonly injuring the laudable pride of my own staff. If I attempted to curb the policeman, I might drive him off to Scotland Yard, where the clue would be followed up, and my own professional credit with the tradesman injured. I must put up with a little of this altercation and endeavor to soothe the irritation of both. The fact is that somebody, an omnibus driver, I believe, had told the police officer that something he was accustomed to see was a jolly rum affair. The policeman, being on the beat along which my man had to travel, and knowing him, repeated his information, and echoed the busman's opinion in his own vernacular. My assistant joined in the opinion already expressed, and went beyond it. "It is a rum affair, as you say," observed my man. "I think," he added, "that it's a clue to what we very particularly want to find out. You come up to the governor with me tomorrow, when you're off duty, and I'll introduce you. If we turn it to account, mind, he'll not be unhandsome. He'll make it worth your while. That I warrant." They then chattered over the business, and I dare say my assistant let the officer into the secret of our instructions far enough to aid his comprehension of the gravity of the effects to which this clue might lead. What then was this clue? I dare say asks the always impatient reader. It was a small matter. It did not seem to point directly at the information I wanted, but many a real clue has not been more definite or reliable than that now to be followed to its end. It was a little nut which required cracking. There might be in it the kernel I wanted, or there might not. with nothing like the regularity of time, but with great frequency, a shabby hack brougham might be seen about, or after dusk, proceeding along a road leading through a western reach of the metropolis into the most picturesque western suburb. My clue began with the vehicle at the northeastern corner of the Green Park, and ended just on the eastern entrance to the village of Haversham. It was a suspicious fact that this hack brougham was not driven by the same man throughout the entire distance. One driver was met about halfway on the road, when he alighted from the box and handed the whip to the person, always the same, who met him. The brougham was one of those registered at Somerset House as a cab. It was a private vehicle, which appeared like the property of some indigent postmaster or jobber. Where could this vehicle go to and come from? Among the difficulties in our case was that of tracing the goods. It was, I confess, not a little remarkable that no part of the goods could be traced. We had searched all the most notorious fences. I do not think there was one known place in which goods of the kind in question would be brought that we had not examined. Could this brougham be the means of conveying the plunder in small quantities to and from its place of concealment to the place or places of conversion into money? Those were questions we determined to solve. A diligent watch was set at stages from the Green Park to Haversham. Next evening the carriage did not present itself, nor the next. But on the third evening it was seen to emerge from a lane in Piccadilly, near to a street in which there is an inferior livery stable. It was now followed and kept in sight during its entire journey. I saw the driver changed. I critically scanned the hirsute visage of the rider. Just outside the village of Knoxbury, on the high road, there stood, and yet stands, a cottage residence, in not the finest state, with coach-house and stabling for more carriages and horses than the occupants seemed to make use of. The house was, I may also explain, shut out from the view of travellers by a close wooden paling, a high gate, and a tall, dense, leafy hedge, making it very hard to see what was going on. At this cottage, the brougham stopped. The rider alighted, and the servant placed the horse and vehicle in the outbuildings allotted to them, which were entered by the rear. All this looked to me very suspicious. I determined, however, to pursue my inquiries. There was not yet enough evidence, in my own opinion, to justify an application for a search warrant, and less justification for anyone's arrest on a criminal charge. Inquiries in the village and neighborhood elicited not much, but the few scraps of fact that we did get tended to fortify a suspicion that there was a depot of the plunder. The tradespeople were pumped, but those wells of gossip or scandal were nearly dry. The truth was, this cottage neither excited remark by ostentation, nor the reverse. What it required, it ordered and paid for. The trade done with its inmates by the shopkeepers who were honored with their patronage was not large enough to arouse the envy of their rivals. It may astonish some people, who are tormented by scandal, to know that rumor may either be avoided or manipulated, if you know how to go about the task. While I was engaged in these inquiries, with two of my assistants, the man who had the words with the policeman, as described, had another, and what he called a jolly row, with that officer. The matter was, I believe, through this, mentioned at the headquarters of the Metropolitan Police, and the authorities took it up. An active sergeant of the detective police called upon me and asked for information, which I thought myself scarcely at liberty to refuse to give, so I gave it. He forthwith set to work and got warrants to search the premises and arrest the inmates. The time he selected for pouncing on the suspects was 12 at night. That evening the shabby brougham turned out of the livery stables, wended its way through slush and traffic along Piccadilly, and at about the usual spot the driver was changed. Away the brougham went again, at a slightly accelerated pace, as though the horse's head was lightened. The party alighted at the cottage, and the stable was occupied as before. About 12:30 a body of police effected an entrance into the cottage by the rear. The whole of the small household was aroused. Great was the consternation of Miss Goodwin, and her brother was nearly killed by alarm. Of the rest, not much different can be said. Groom and coachman, one person. Housekeeper and general servant, also one person, who completed the human establishment, were frightened awfully. The highly intelligent sergeant insisted upon ransacking the house, searching the stables and exploring the garden. In the meantime, the lady, gentlemen, and servants were told to consider themselves in custody. In vain the gentlemen protested against this outrage, and sometimes gently threatened to bring down all the vengeance of the law upon his sister's tormentors. The sergeant treated the threat with disdain, and ridiculed the claim of his prisoner to kinship with Miss Goodwin. All entreaties, menaces, expostulations, and threats were answered by references to his duty, or intimations that he knew what he was about. The search and exploration revealed nothing. The officer was sorely disappointed, but not yet discomfited. He saw that, at all events, he was safe if he went on, and that if he turned back, he might expose himself to the charge of negligence. There was enough that was wrong, more than sufficient that was mysterious, to cover any excess of vigilance or any stretch of duty. So on he resolved to go. When Mr. Goodwin was told that he must accompany the officer as his prisoner, and that the lady must also share that inconvenience, they again put forth every form of remonstrance. All were useless. The officer was inexorable and unbelieving. He rudely expressed his disbelief of the assertion that the fair tenant of the college was a pure and innocent young lady, of small, independent estate, and that the visitor was her brother and guardian. Those explanations, he said, might do for the magistrate tomorrow, but they would not do for the police. There was no getting out of the awful mess. Mr. and Miss Goodwin were removed by the sergeant, under his warrants, to the chief metropolitan police station, and there confined in vulgar cells. At times during the wretched journey to London, the prisoners were defiant, and at others they sank into despair. Once, on the way to the metropolis, the lady remarked to her companion, "Never mind, dear George. We're not thieves. They've searched my house in every part, but they have found nothing." "Now," observed the officer, "don't say anything that'll injure yourselves while I'm with you. I don't want you to criminate yourselves. Only mind, I shall give all that I hear as evidence, and I don't mind saying that I don't like the look of things. Found nothing. Well, if that sort of talk ain't thieves' patter, I don't know what is. I ain't found nothing yet, but if I get a remand, won't I find nothing?" Mr. Goodwin shuddered. Miss Goodwin was eloquent in the form of denunciation. The gentleman, by the time of the arrival of the party at the station house, had recovered his self-possession. He demanded the means of communicating with the solicitor. A lawyer was afforded him. He chose the name of a well-known criminal practitioner, one of the cleverest and one of the most respectable of his class. The professional man recognized his client. He had before been employed as the agent of that client's family solicitor in a prosecution. Within 10 minutes after the arrival of the lawyer at the station, the door of Mr. Goodwin's cell was opened, and that gentleman, with his attorney, were shown into the head private apartment of the officer who lives on the premises. Miss Goodwin was also looked after with as much tenderness during her stay in this urban hostelry. After a short further interview between the attorney and the gentleman, and a few words with the lady in compulsory waiting, a conference was held between the magistrate, his learned clerk, and the attorney. Mr. and Miss Goodwin were then next shown into his worship's private room, and the brother and sister were liberated on their own recognizances. Nothing further was done in the case against the occupants of the suburban cottage. Nothing was done by that lady and gentleman against any other person for setting the law in motion against them. The vigilant sergeant got promoted. On what theory and by what influences? Let the reader guess. Was it as a reward for past clever and prudent service? Was it the price of perpetual silence? Was it the seal upon a mystery? I cannot explain why the sergeant was thus dealt with, but as much of some other things I can properly explain, I will. First, let me say that I had no further interference by the police with my plans for the detection of the real thieves, and that I hunted them down to conviction. In the second place, I may inform the reader that Mr. Goodwin was no other than Alias for His Grace the Duke of No Matter Where, a nobleman who boasts of a long pedigree, and whose own father was not a little proud of the historic traditions of the House of No Matter Where. The living Duke has a large rent roll, an almost infinitesimal portion of which goes to Miss Goodwin, who, although not a sister, is in very intimate relationship toward him. He had reasons of his own, I dare say, for the quiet, or, as I should say, mysterious manner in which his visits to the cottage in the western suburb were shrouded. And now you know the Duke's mystery. We'll return with our second story, Matrimonial Espionage, right after these sponsor messages. And now, Matrimonial Espionage. Among the curiosities of my experience, I reckon the incidents of the narrative I'm about to relate. A few years ago, a gentleman of considerable estate, one of the untitled nobility of England, called upon me and explained that he had reason to suspect the fidelity of his wife. I did not recognize the force of these reasons. The facts on which this gloomy, although partial, faith in the lady's impurity or falseness had been raised might, with strict literal accuracy, be described as trifles light as air. The suspicion was, however, not to be wholly disregarded by a stranger at the first blush of the case. My visitor's station in life, his intellectual qualifications, and his affection for his wife appeared like guarantees that he would not condemn her without cause. He did not, however, assert with confidence that she was guilty. All he had, or professed to have, was a doubt. He told me that nothing would give him more delight than a perfect conviction that he had been under a delusion about the lady. Perhaps it would be well to describe somewhat more fully the actors in this curious little drama. Mr. Percival was the only son of a wealthy and improving landowner in the county of Sussex. He had, in consequence, inherited his father's whole landed estate, together with a large sum of money, and considerable investments in public funds and other reliable securities. His education had been well cared for. He lost his mother when only about 14 years of age, and his character had, it is probable, suffered from want of the chastening influences of maternal care. This was, however, the only defect, if it were a defect, in his training. His father had anxiously watched the conduct and the development of his youth. He had been educated at Eton, where he excelled in more than one branch of study. At Oxford, he took honors. He was a superior type of the class known as country gentleman. His habits were those of a man of culture and a man of fortune. Mrs. Percival was a lady of good, although comparatively poor, family. Her father rejoiced in the title of an Irish landlord, but the rent roll of the estate was not very considerable, and it needed dexterous management to keep it from the withering grasp of the encumbered estates court. Still, out of their slender resources, Mrs. Percival's parents had given her a superior education. She could draw, she was a skillful and good musician, she was an elegant horsewoman, and otherwise accomplished. Her manners were free and natural, sometimes a little childlike. She was a little, and but a little, above the average stature of her sex, had a graceful mien, and a sweet face. If I were expert in drawing pen and ink sketches after the manner of a novelist, I should describe this lady as an almost perfect woman. The reader will understand that I have, in this description, anticipated the narrative so far as to let him know more of the lady and the gentleman than I could learn within a period of 2 months. You will excuse my candor, sir, I hope, but I fail to see the grounds for your suspicion of your wife. I like your candor. It is reassuring. I may be mistaken. I devoutly pray that I am. You have, I am told, had great experience in such painful domestic affairs as that I now trouble you with. It is already a source of much comfort to me that I have consulted you. If you can remove the horrid doubts which oppress me, I shall esteem you my benefactor. But let me know the truth, whatever that may be. I again begged him to be a little more precise than he had been in detailing the cause of his suspicions. In solemn confidence, I may say that we were at a dinner party at the house of Mr. Tallboys, in Seymour Place, the week before last, and it was impossible to avoid noticing her freedom with young Lord Swellington and Colonel Forjour. "The Colonel," I said, "he's a man of 60. He has seen much hard service, and is a lion in every party just now, I've heard. Were not your wife's attentions more courtesies, which all true women find pleasure in bestowing upon age and bravery?" "That might be. But what do you say about her pleasantries with that conceited and empty-headed young fop, Lord Swellington?" I answered, "These might be the innocent raillery and badinage of the purest woman. Ladies sometimes take a cruel pleasure in trifling with, just to mortify the fop, in whatever grade of society he may be found. Well, I sincerely hope you are right, but, unhappily, these have not been the only causes of my grief. My wife is too fond of pleasure. We have lately been at two public breakfasts, one given by Lady Wellington at Kew, another by the Marchioness of Littlemore at Chiswick. That, pardon my suggesting, under the most adverse and at the same time rational estimate of human character, betrays only something of levity, quite consistent with purity of heart and the strictest rectitude of conduct. You are not, I am glad to say, an uncharitable interpreter of human conduct. Oh, indeed, I hope not, for although I have seen much wickedness and a vast deal of subtle, as well as patent, crime, I have met with many instances in which unjust suspicions have provoked calamities. But was there anything, and if so, what was there, in the conduct of your wife to justify your suspicions about her? Well, she flirted with every gentleman present at each party, young and old. With everyone? Yes, or nearly so. This is enough to show the groundlessness of your apprehensions. Mrs. Percival may have been too richly endowed with vivacity, but my suspicion is that her freedom arises, in great part, from her conscious guilelessness and her moral self-possession. Again, I say I hope you may be right, and I wrong. Why so emphasize the word hope? Have you observed any other instances of what you deem your wife's impropriety? Yes, he replied. Then relate them. The other day my wife induced me to take her to the flower show held in the gardens of the Botanic Society, Regent's Park. She asked you to take her? I interposed. Yes, and I did so. I yield everything she desires. And why not, as I am not certain that her affections wander? Quite correct. But did anything occur there? Well, perhaps you would deem it nothing. She hung on the arm of Colonel Forshore for a couple of hours.
The old Indian colonel?
Yes.
Well, really, I don't see anything in that. I happened to be at that show myself with Mrs. Forrester and a distinguished relative of ours. I remember that among the flowers were several oriental plants, which our florists have succeeded in naturalizing. This is one of the most common incidents of a flower show.
I wish I could look upon these things as you do. A single incident of the kind might not have aroused my apprehensions, but so many, and at various times furnish a collective evidence impossible to resist.
How long have you been married?
A little more than 2 years.
Any family?
No.
I was quite convinced, as the reader must be, that there was really nothing in the conduct of Mrs. Percival to justify the cruel suspicions of her husband. His employment of me would, I saw, be one of the absurdest things he could very well do.
Should I allow him to employ me? Ought I to permit myself to be used as a spy upon his wife's movements, being so firmly convinced as I was of her innocence?
The mystery of this jealousy was capable of a simple explanation. The lady had been endowed by nature with a somewhat mercurial disposition, which her education had done little to check. The very scenes in which her girlhood had been spent had inspired her with a wild and playful tendency. Nothing in her married life had yet happened to curb or control the innocent gaiety, or it might be waywardness, of her disposition. Had her union with Mr. Percival been blessed by offspring, of which, is needless to say, there was yet no ground for despair, it is most probable that at dinner parties she would have been a less attractive member. At public breakfasts she would have been less chatty or facetious. At flower shows, a little less anxious inquirer. But should I, or should I not, undertake to confirm or remove the unjust husband's suspicions? Upon this, I just couldn't make up my mind. I required time for consideration. It was arranged that Mr. Percival should see me again in 3 days. During the interval between his first and second visits, I carefully balanced reasons for and against the engagement, and at length resolved to accept it. If I did not undertake it, I knew others would, if it were offered them. If they took it in hand, I was not at all sure that they would perform their task with becoming delicacy and consideration. I thought it not improbable that some rude or vulgar man might be instructed, and that he might, by starting on his inquiry with a foregone conclusion of the lady's guilt, so interpret what he saw of her pre-conduct as to increase her husband's jealousy. On the other hand, if I undertook the affair, I doubted not the result would be a vindication of Mrs. Percival in her husband's eyes. Mr. Percival punctually kept his appointment with me. He was the first to speak. "I hope," he said, "you have agreed to assist me."
"I have."
"Well, I shall feel grateful to you when you have probed the truth. Doubly grateful, if you can prove that my doubts about my wife are unfounded. I expect to earn that double gratitude."
"Be it so," he said, with great emphasis. "It is no drawback on your professional merits, to my mind, that you have already formed that opinion that my wife is as good as I could wish her, and that I am a jealous fool. I should not like to know that you have condemned her beforehand. I am persuaded that you will do your duty faithfully towards me, and considerately towards her."
I promised him that much.
There was a ball at Almack's the very next day. Mrs. Percival was to be there, and so was her husband. They would go separately, after the manner of the ton, she in her brougham, and he in his cab. I did not think Almack's a desirable place to begin my inquiries in. It would not be easy for me to gain admission into this closest of all assemblies, although I could have encompassed that, as I had before. I preferred a standpoint of observation where etiquette was less rigid. Next week there was to be a grand fancy dress ball under a potent body of lady patronesses for the relief of starvation in Whitechapel, and Mrs. Percival, acting under the feeble light of conventional charity, thought it her duty to buy a ticket, price 1 guinea, of which an infinitesimal portion was netted for the indigent, and to largely patronize her dressmaker and milliner in proof of her intense sympathy with the famishing poor. I attended this ball, and was sickened by its palpable mockery of the distress it was ostensibly designed to relieve, but I must not get off the track of my narrative to moralize. At this ball I saw nothing to justify a suspicion of impropriety on the part of Mrs. Percival, nor did I at a flower show which was held in the grounds of the Crystal Palace at Sydenham, nor at a public breakfast which the Marchioness of Livermore gave in her grounds at Chiswick. A more private scrutiny of the lady's movements also went to prove her strictly virtuous in character. I now got wearied and half disgusted with my task, and brought it to an end by reporting to Mr. Percival my absolute conviction of his wife's innocence and purity. He received my statement without offering any opinion upon it, and it was evident that he was not quite satisfied with it. It had, I dare say, weakened his suspicions, but it had not destroyed them. I was sorry for the imperfect result, but I could do no more than I had done for his satisfaction. I often mused and reflected over this curious case. What could have given rise to these suspicions in the mind of such a man as Mr. Percival? I set it down to incompatibility of temper. He was a somewhat studious and retiring man. His wife, although as good a woman as ever drew breath, was a light and somewhat volatile person. In many respects, I argued, this is an incongruous union. I thought I saw inevitable misery for both husband and wife in the future. About a year after I had finished my proper business with Mr. and Mrs. Percival, I was waited upon by an eminent London solicitor, who knew nothing of my former engagement, for the purpose of tracing the retreat of that gentleman, who had deserted his wife and was hiding from all his friends. My visitor, the private solicitor of Mr. Percival, had not heard from him since or about his flight. It was not supposed that any violence had befallen him, although it was hard to say what harm might befall him. His physician had advised that he had been suffering from one of the 1,000 forms of one of the 100 branches of that disorder known by the familiar collective title of insanity. It was a mild and harmless type of the disease, a species of melancholia. The friends of the unfortunate gentleman were anxious to discover, and perhaps secretly watch over, him, at the worst, place him under gentle and temporary restraint. As he was known to be a man of high and honorable ambition, very likely to obtain and worthily fill a seat in Parliament, unless his prospects were marred, publicity, scandal, or gossip, on the subject of his bereavement, was to be deprecated. I accepted this engagement, and I thought it desirable to let the solicitor know of the previous retainer given me by Mr. Percival, so that he might restate the facts to the physician,
who would thereby gain some insight into the secret of the gentleman's misfortune. We had no clue to Mr. Percival's whereabouts. Certain facts led us to imagine he had not left this country, but I put myself in communication with the French and Belgian police as the best mode of tracing him if he had crossed the sea. I had all the provincial papers filed at Peel's and Deacon's coffee houses critically scanned, so that if any harm befell him, I should hear of it. This was a precaution I added to the usual police inquiry through the hue and cry. One day I got intelligence through a West of England paper that a gentleman, answering to the description of Mr. Percival, had been found wandering along the coast in a state which indicated mental disorganization. I lost no time in proceeding to the spot with the doctor and with Mrs. Percival, who insisted upon being of the party. We claimed the poor man, who yielded himself up to our control like an infant. We brought him to London and took apartments for him in a western suburb, so as to be out of the eye of gossips and near to that of his physician. It is perhaps needless to say that his wife attended on him mainly with her own hands, and would let none but the rudest offices be performed by any other person. Carriage rides, gentle exercise, and tonic medicines told beneficially on the patient day by day, so that in a few weeks, under the doctor's advice, arrangements were made to take him in his own yacht to the north of Europe. The physician explained to me that the secret of his malady was disappointed or impatient ambition. He was an only son. He had inherited, with his father's property, that gentleman's desire to establish a house. He feared that the curse of sterility had fallen on him or his wife, and the constant brooding over this thought had curdled jealousy in his heart. In the north of Europe, Mr. Percival's mental health was completely restored. On his return to England, he called upon me and thanked me very sincerely for the part I'd played in the narrative I've described, stating that if anything could exceed the claims I had upon his gratitude for the attention I had bestowed upon him, it would be the faithful manner in which I had combated and sought to destroy his unfounded suspicions of his wife. A better or nobler woman did not, he said, exist. She had, he feared, impaired her health by her vigilant attention to him during his illness, and the only grief he now had was the apprehension that, being with child, the change of air and continental travel, which had just been recommended for her sake, would be adequate to restore a vigor and tone to her delicate system. I am happy, however, in being able to state that these fears have not been realized. Mr. and Mrs. Percival, who are among the very happiest people in the world, the health of both in mind and in body being as nearly perfect as they can be, have two sons, with the prospect of contributing more guarantees against the termination of their pedigree in this generation. The end. Hope you enjoyed these two stories from Andrew Forrester, his real name, James Redding Ware. If you enjoy our storytelling here, please do send us a review, Apple listeners, or comment, Spotify listeners. We always appreciate reviews and comments at 1001 Classic Short Stories and Tales. Until next time, everyone, take care, and we'll be back soon.